The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning, 4 minutes past nine for this Thursday, the 5th of February, 2026. I do hope we find you well this morning. It's nice and dry, but that rain that is pounding the east and south of the country, it's going to make its way up here, as you heard from Donald there in the afternoon. Thankfully, for once, we aren't getting the worst of it, which means really there's an awful lot of talk of weather on the national news, isn't there? But anyway, here we are to focus on local matters with an eye on national and international affairs as well. Right, how do you get in touch with us? Well, we will remind you early on, as we always do, of the contact details. The WhatsApp and text number, that's 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000. If you want to give us a call, Caroline and Shannon taking your calls this morning, 07491 25000. And your emails come into us, comments at highlandradio.com, comments at highlandradio.com. Right, let's have a look at the papers. Thursday means there's a bumper pile. We'll start with a very interesting story. Well, it's interesting to me, on the front of the Tyrconnell Tribune. Gales and weather turbulence of the past year have drilled down 2 metres of sand, estimated at tens of thousands of cubic metres around Ballymastocker Bay. And the displacement may also have solved the last resting place of HMS Saldanha, the 950-tonne frigate perished in Lough Swilly in 1811, with the loss of over 250 lives. And over the weekend, low tides in the loch revealed a substantial superstructure of timbers thought to be part of the frigate. The timbers are 12 inches in width and are held together by dowels, which were in use until the 1830s. And as I say, it's remarkable. Nature has revealed potentially the wreck after hundreds of years, and maybe solved a mystery of what happened to the HMS Saldanha. I hope to speak a little bit more about that later on in the programme. The Donegal News this morning, a Donegal pensioner has spoken out about how he almost fell victim to a convincing scam that could have given fraudsters full access to his bank details and mobile phone. Eamon O'Donnell received a call from people purporting to be from a leading telecommunications provider, and coincidentally the call came after he himself had complained to his provider about slow internet speed. So good bit of information there in the papers to help us avoid such scams. The Derry News this morning. University students arriving to Derry in September past felt unwelcome, according to Stephen Kelly, chair of the Ulster University McGee Task Force. Mr. Kelly made his remarks on Tuesday afternoon during his presentation of the McGee Expansion Task Force update, 1 year on, January 2026 report, to Derry City and Strabane District Council's Governance and Strategic Planning Committee. Students were feeling unwelcome during that period, and we know that's not the Derry way, so we want to make sure that they actually feel welcome when they are here, Mr. Kelly told the councillors. Staying with students, and just to give you more details of the students of St. Eunan's, as Lee mentioned on his programme just towards the end there, they are in the market square this morning collecting signatures for their petition. So they're there from 9 a.m. until lunchtime. So it costs you nothing, and your support would be greatly appreciated. And it's not the most fantastic morning to be standing out, but they're doing it for all the right reasons. They're trying to gather signatures to impress on the Minister for Education that the long-awaited redevelopment extension, enhancement of St. Eunan's College, must be included in the latest tranche of funding for schools. Just one school, St. Columba's in the Twin Towns. Thankfully, it was included in this multi-billion-euro scheme. But nothing in Sligo, Mayo, Leitrim, Donegal, except that one school. Ministers rule out immediate social media ban for children. We're following this up because we talked about it as if it were a fait accompli. And the reason we did that is because Simon Harris, in two interviews, gave the impression that it was very much a fait accompli. He talked of a under-16 social media ban within weeks. Well, the Irish Times tells us that Ireland will not follow other countries and pass a law creating a social media ban for children in the short term, even as European Union members states advance their own plans for age limits. Minister for Media Patrick O'Donovan said he would bring forward online child safety measures incrementally, and he talked down proposals being brought forward by other countries. There's laws that children could potentially get around. Well, listen, if there's a will, there's a way. But anyway, it's up to them what they do, isn't it? France, Spain and Greece have recently announced plans to ban social media for children under the age of 15 or 16. Non-EU countries such as Australia and the UK have announced their own online age limits. Canada is also considering a similar proposal. And as I say, Simon Harris gave the impression this was just on the cards. But Minister for Media, Patrick O'Donovan, which I'd be very interested in a chat with him, if we could try and organise that, Caroline, just to get a sense of where he's at in the whole conversation. He doesn't seem to be in any rush. Now, is this because we're taking a more balanced approach to it? Let's not do anything in a knee-jerk way. Or is it because these companies are based here in Ireland and we're concerned about what the ramifications or implications could be? I don't know. It was an interesting conversation we had on the Friday panel last Friday with our three guests there, one of them being Senator Eileen Flynn. And all three ladies who were on that panel all had their reservations about under 16s, look at it a bit further, you know, paraphrasing here, but, you know, some 15-year-olds are more mature than others. I propose that, you know, you could have a 15-year-old in this county who's the principal carer for an adult in the family and they couldn't go on Facebook. You know, it is a conversation that is worth teasing out. But when other countries are doing something and then we take a different approach and we host all of these big companies, it does make me think, but that's just perhaps my cynical mind. What about your minds on the issues of immigration or migration? This is in the Irish Independent. Irish people are more concerned about uncontrolled migration flows than other EU counterparts are, according to a new survey. The latest European Parliament Eurobarometer survey shows 75% of those surveyed in Ireland said they were highly worried about uncontrolled migration flows. This compares with 65% of those surveyed for the study across the EU. So 75% of you are highly worried about uncontrolled migration flows. It's an interesting question because the argument could be made that there aren't uncontrolled migration flows. But anyway, maybe that's for another day. A total of 13% of Irish respondents were moderately worried, while 12% say they were not slightly worried. More than 1,000 Irish people were interviewed as part of the survey last November, with 26,453 face-to-face interviews conducted with citizens across EU member states for the report. Now, while migration remains a significant concern for those in Ireland, those interviewed said they believed the European Parliament's priority should be to address inflation and rising costs. So whilst the headline in the story is about migration, what is of greater concern to the Irish is inflation and rising costs, which I think perhaps could have featured a little bit further up in that article there. We often talk on this programme, and other people do as well, about cash and the importance of cash. But the point I've made over the years is that I think it's important that we maintain access to cash for many, many reasons. But the reality is that as new generations come into this whole sphere of spending and earning, that cash will become, you know, people are tapping with their watches, with their phones, with their cards. You know, cash really, just a lot of people don't deal with it. Whether you want it to be enshrined, which it is, or if you want ATMs everywhere, and if you want all shops to take cash, the truth is more and more people are choosing not to use cash themselves. And the evidence is from Christmas. Shoppers left it to the last minute to buy their Christmas goods last year, with December 23rd, the busiest day on record for tap-and-go payments. There were more than 2 million contactless payments by Bank of Ireland customers on the day, and that boom was matched by contactless card transactions using digital wallets such as Apple Pay or Google Pay, which increased by 10% when compared to the same time in 2024. The bank said contactless payments surged to record levels. So in one day, 2 million of those, and that represents a 10% increase on the previous year. So as I say, naturally, whether people like it or not, people are moving away from cash. Now, the Irish Farmers Journal, we covered yesterday because there's quite a strong Donegal interest, but also a national interest in the protests the IFA are undertaking at Bord Bia. And the Irish Farmers Journal warns, or reports, sorry, there were no signs of the Irish Farmers Association backing off from its protest at Bord Bia's head offices in Ballsbridge, Dublin, as the Irish Farmers Journal was going to print. Tuesday saw a group of IFA protesters make their way into the lobby area of the building, a move that Bord Bia said had been pulled off under false pretenses. Wednesday marked day 10 of the protest, that is, seeking the removal of Larry Moran from his role as Bord Bia chair, as 14 IFA members remained inside the building while others took up positions outside. They want him gone because he runs a factory that uses Brazilian beef, and he's there really to say Irish beef is the best beef ever. Buy it in Spain, buy it in Germany, buy it in Britain, buy it in China. But he himself is using Brazilian beef, and I think people can understand that that might make his messaging feel a little bit, I don't know, watered down. The Irish Daily Star, again, this is a follow-up of a story we've covered extensively on this programme because it's an important one. And there will be a presumption of non-disclosure of counselling notes in sexual offence trials under measures signed off by Cabinet. Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan wants to legislate that such records are only released where a judge decides after a disclosure hearing that they contain evidence relevant to the legal proceedings. That seems to make sense. That seems to be a good stopgap. Because also, too, you do have to consider that there is a truth to be found as well. The minister said the measures would restrict the use of counselling notes as far as possible after Attorney General's advice that a complete ban would be unconstitutional. O'Callaghan said the default position will be that counselling notes are not to be disclosed, save for the very small number of cases where disclosure is ordered by a judge and warranted in the interests of justice. So I presume, and I'm not a legal, that the judge would have a hearing whereby the argument for the disclosure of the notes would be made. Presumably he would have access or she would have access to those notes, and then a determination would be made. But the default position is that your counselling notes, when you're confiding in someone in a private space after a traumatic event, the default position would that they would not be disclosed. And finally, the Irish Daily Mirror. Two members of a three-person disciplinary panel to hear jailed teacher Enoch Burke's appeal over his dismissal have resigned, the High Court heard yesterday. Lawyers for the disciplinary appeals panel told Mr Justice Brian Cregan and Sean O'Langan and Jack Cleary, he told them that Sean O'Langan and Jack Cleary quit in light of issues arising in a legal challenge brought by the Burkes to stop the panel from taking further steps in the appeal process. Barrister Port Lyons SC for the panel said, told the court the specific issues giving rise to the resignations were legally privileged, but said the move would avoid protracted legal proceedings and clear the way for a new panel to be nominated to hear Burke's appeal. Now, I didn't, the reasons for the resignations are legally protected. I think the Burkes did a video where they were divulged. I'm not 100% sure, but I believe they were. Eurogiant is set to review its entire store network after entering court-appointed liquidation. The owners of the discount retail chain, which operates two branches in Letterkenny and one in Donegal Town, were placed into liquidation by the High Court. Eurogiant currently operates 77 stores nationwide and employs 644 people across Ireland. Damien O'Reilly is a senior lecturer in marketing and management in the School of Retail and Service Management at the Technical University in Dublin. Thank you for joining us, Damien.
Good morning, Greg.
This is obviously sad news, difficult news for the company, but not news that perhaps wasn't flagged in recent years that they were in trouble.
The group reported combined losses up to October of last year of around $6.5 million. And this is on top of the main shareholder, Charlie O'Loughlin, having pumped in $2.5 million of his own money into the company to try and keep it afloat. But as you said, you know, it's tough competition out there, and they had their trials and tribulations over the last number of years. If you went back to COVID, and they sourced a lot of their products from China, logistic prices. The price of a container, to bring a container of goods from China, was very, very expensive at the time. And that put a lot of pressure on the company and the finances of the company. Then they moved their sourcing to a lot to the UK. And in 2021, the Brexit tariffs kicked in, and that made it more expensive. Plus, they lost a line of credit to in the UK, which made sourcing a little more difficult, payment for product more difficult. And on top of that, led to some shortages within the store. So yeah, it's something that's been gaining momentum now that we see that it has actually folded.
Yeah, and like all other businesses as well, they've faced increased costs at home between energy. A lot of those stores are, you know, hard to maintain in terms of just heat and lighting. Wage increases, you know, obviously pension, alter enrollment pension. If your business model is that, you know, you are trying to keep prices as low as possible, there was an awful lot of pressure on them, presumably, to stay in that space.
Yeah, like rent and rates are increasing. Employee costs, as you said, there have increased significantly. And, you know, it's been difficult, especially in the locations that they're in. They're not in kind of tertiary locations. They're in kind of not main street, but secondary locations, you know, and the rent and rates are quite high. And as you said, it's a cutthroat business. You know, they've got a lot of competition from the likes of Mr. Price and Deals. And then as well as that, with the supermarkets been able to offering discounts on products now that they weren't before. So it's not that there's a price war, but margins are very tight in that kind of industry now at the moment.
Yeah, and an awful lot of people in their space, as you mentioned, the key competitors, but also to your middle aisles and other offers that be happening here, there and everywhere. It does make it very difficult. What does it mean when a company goes into liquidation? Because obviously, you know, the staff now, I'm not sure how much information they have, how much certainty they have. 644 across Ireland, many of those in the stores in Letterkenny and in Donegal Town. So when a company goes into liquidation, what really is that? What's happening there?
It's they will try and sell the company off. If we went into examinership, there would be a possibility that the company would be bought over. They'd be given a 100 days or so to actually come up with some kind of rescue package. Liquidation means that the companies have gone out of business, and most likely they'd be sold off either individually or as collectively the ones that may be profitable. So it's not good news for the employees, even though in the short term they're going to still operate. But it's not good news for the people working there at the moment.
So do you think it's unlikely the entire outfit would be built as a going concern, and instead, you know, our company or companies would cherry pick the best locations?
Well, I don't want to preempt what's going to happen, but I mean, if the company was in a situation where they could do an examinership, and they've looked at that, it would seem from what I'm reading on the news feeds, is that they've looked at an examinership and that doesn't seem to be feasible. So it looks like the stores will close down, and maybe, you know, other competitors may want to take over some of the stores themselves. But I think it's you know, that remains to be seen. I don't want to speculate on that.
No, of course.
Some of the stores must be profitable.
Yes, of course. And as you've already indicated, a lot of them are quite spacious and in quite attractive locations as well. Do you think this is, we're going to see more of this into the future? Like, in other words, are we seeing a more difficult trading environment, or is Eurogiant really just got all of the headwinds going, given, you know, the margins and the area it operates in and what have you?
Yeah, it's that people have become familiar with the products that they sell. It's very easy to do comparisons when you go into a store that has a limited amount of products like the Eurospars or Mr. Deals or Mr. Price. So it's easier to do that. And it's not that we're falling out of love with budget shopping, far from it, because we're notionally, and I don't like the term crisis anymore, but the cost of living is still expensive for many people. And what's happening is the shoppers have become got smarter. They're, you know, they're taking photographs of saying, here's the price of something here and here's the price of something there. So, you know, the buyers know the prices inside out, and it's putting a lot of pressure on the likes of Eurogiant. So, but, you know, if you take something similar in the UK, like the Poundland shops have suffered a lot. Now, one of the reasons is that for them is that the pound shop was associated with the pound, and when it opened in 1919, the same time as actually as Eurogiant, you know, it's only worth 45 to 50 cents or pence today, a pound. And the euro, I know the Eurogiant is not associated with the euro because it happened actually before the it was launched before the euro came into effect. But you know,
there is an expectation too, though, isn't there? I know it's not
the expectation. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, I tell you, retailers, they have to be more savvy and to try and understand what their customer is going to buy before they actually know what they're going to buy. So it's getting them into store with produce that they want to buy, and then adding something on that has an extra margin.
And not carrying too much tat and knowing what's going to be coming in trend and all that kind of stuff. All right, listen, thank you very much indeed for your insight, Damien. That's Damien O'Reilly, Senior Lecturer in Marketing and Management in the School of Retail and Services Management at the Technological University in Dublin. Sad news and thinking on the staff at the start of the year. This uncertainty, and it doesn't feel like it's good news. As I mentioned, Eurogiant into liquidation, 77 stores nationwide. You're familiar with the logos, you're familiar with the stores. They're based in Letterkenny. They've got two stores there, and one also in Donegal Town. Caller says Donegal Airport needs to have the runway extended by 500 metres. Then we could accommodate 737 aircraft. We could then introduce Ryanair to the fray. Interesting. I would imagine that all of that has been explored. It can be quite hard to get a Ryanair into an airport, but I presume there's been a, a cost-benefit analysis. On the issue of traffic in Remelton, there are major traffic issues in Remelton. The town is not fit for the size of this project, and workers are in cramped spaces and too much traffic. It's a total mess, and the biggest work on the Shore Road is still not underway because there is no traffic plan unless they close it to traffic. Every unit there is occupied and the politicians have no answers. The council has ignored the problems, hoping they'd go away. We are getting sort of messages here and there about the Remelton situation. I know John McAteer's written extensively about it in the Tyrconnell Tribune, and I presume it's been carried in other papers. But if you are affected by this, either a resident or a business person, please get in touch with us, 0749125000. On Brazilian beef, the IFA are looking to get rid of Larry Mullen. The meat factories are backing Larry Mullen. 90% of the workforce in meat factories are foreign workers, 80% are Brazilian. Well, I'm not sure about those stats. But anyway, they have a contact that brings them to Ireland and they are given contracted hours. They get a subsidy if they don't get all their hours. Well, it is one of those industries whereby people are employed from overseas. We dish out far more work visas in this country than people who would arrive here looking for international protection or for that matter. The majority of the population change in this country is driven by legal movement of people, effectively. But the bottom line is the Brazilian beef is there. They're competing. They're trying to get their meat out into the wider market. That's why they're trying to get the Mercosur deal over the line. And Brazilian beef, I think, is more common in this country than people might realise, if the truth be told. I would have some information in relation to that that I'm trying to get some details on. On the Jeffrey Donaldson case, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Jeffrey Donaldson will never stand trial. The unfit to give evidence due to ill health is the standard excuse used by people of influence to avoid accountability. Dee Forbes of RTE still claiming to be too ill. Is she still being sought to appear before the Oireachtas Committee? But anyway, this caller says that Ms. Forbes has successfully avoided answering questions about how taxpayers' money was spent. Mrs. Donaldson will contract another mysterious illness before the court may court date, unless they decouple them at some point. You know, maybe they'll have to consider that. Hi, Greg. I was at the Donegal match on Sunday. I think it's terrible that after the match, the kids run onto the pitch to get autographs, and within 5 to 10 minutes, the coaching staff is pulling the players off the pitch. I think it's not right because the kids are paying and it's the players' management that reap the rewards. I know the players would stay out all day, But if the it's the coaches that are pulling them away, they're not catching a plane. It's an interesting one. I mean, I suppose they've just given their all for 70 plus minutes and exhausted. And, you know, it's a professional game now. I mean, of course, it's an amateur sport, but it's a professional game. And really, people aren't supposed to be on the pitch. I don't know what the right answer to that is, to be honest with you. I don't think it's ever going to be the norm whereby players will stay out for 20 minutes to take photos and sign autographs for young people, because it could be, you know, absolute chaos. The bigger the game, more people on the pitch and so on and so forth. But maybe you agree with that listener. They're quite critical of coaches pulling players off the pitch rather than allowing them to stay on the pitch to take autographs or sign autographs and take pictures with young fans who I don't think they're supposed to be on the pitch to begin with. But anyway, I'll throw it out to the wider audience and we'll see what they have to say. On the conversation of flooding, as all the flooding and risk are more down east, south and east, homes, cars and farms all destroyed and no insurance, it's time people spoke up and get out there. The time has come, as this is going to happen on a regular basis all over the country, with environmental and more thought now for the birds than human rivers needing to be cleaned, bushes cut and lowered, which would mean less flooding and also the water would get away faster. Common sense. Yeah, but there's lots we could be doing in relation to that, of course. I don't think it's about birds or anything like that there. I think it's just something, I just think it's something we'd actually need to do in an organised fashion. I'm joined on the programme now by a journalist and member of the organising committee of the Saldanha commemoration, Anne Cadwallader. Good morning to you, Anne.
Good morning, Greg.
Thank you so much for joining us. And potentially a remarkable discovery made recently at Ballymastocker Bay.
Yes, whatever the wreckage is, either way, it's very interesting. And another sign of climate change, the beach has been devastated by the storm that exposed this wreck. If it is the Saldanha, yes, it's a hugely significant discovery. And I'm very glad that it was, somebody saw it. It was a beautiful day last Sunday on the beach. And unfortunately, I didn't know the wreckage was there. Otherwise, I would have gone and had a look. But the story of the Saldanha is tragic from right from the very start. I mean, she was practically a new ship when she went down in that dreadful storm in December 1811, with the loss of everybody that was on board. And we still don't know for sure where the bodies are buried. We think many of them were buried on the golf course. And it was on the golf course, of course, on the 200th anniversary that we had the ecumenical service to at least recall the poor men who all drowned on that night of December the 4th, 1811, in the worst storm, they said, of the whole century. It was a must have been a horrific experience for them, with cannons smashing into the ship and snow and a gale and freezing cold. I mean, God, poor people.
And the discovery of this, could we call it a ship? Do we presume that what has been discovered is a ship of some description? What else would sort of lend itself to this shape and formation?
Yes, it must be a ship of some kind. Who knows? I mean, the Saldanha, what happened was that she set off from Buncrana to blockade the western approaches to Ireland from the depredations of Napoleon. That was her job, along with two other ships, the Endymion and the Talbot. They all set off in good form up Lough Swilly, and they hadn't quite reached the open ocean. If the ship had reached the open ocean, she would have been all right. But she was still in the mouth of Lough Swilly when the storm hit. And the ship had no method of steering. I mean, there was no engine or anything. She was completely dependent on the wind, forced back into Lough Swilly, which was the worst thing that could possibly have happened, because she hit the Swilly rocks and broke into two. And she was already at the mercy of the wind and the waves, and forced back into the Swilly, and there was nothing that anybody could do to save her or the men on board. Absolute tragedy for them.
What do we do next? Because as nature revealed this wreck, you know, it could conceal it again. So is there anything we can do to relieve the speculation and try and find out what exactly this is?
Well, the best thing I can think of that we could do is contact John O'Rourke, who at the time of the 200th commemoration was working on a book on the Saldanha. He'd gone across to London and had looked up all the names on the manifest, that is the list of everybody that was on board. And the names of every single sailor that was on that manifest are reproduced on the plaque that sits, the metal commemorative plaque that is currently still there on the golf course. If you're parking on the main public car park next to the beach at Port Salon, if you look through the mesh that forms the boundary to the golf course, beside the tunnel that goes down onto the beach, you can see the commemorative plaque there, and every single name of every sailor that we know that went down with the Saldanha is on that plaque. And the reason that we have those names is that John O'Rourke, who is a local man from and works with the Letterkenny College and is a volunteer with the lifeboat, he went across to London and went to the National Archives in London and looked up all the information he could find on the Saldanha. Okay. He's as far as I know, he's the world's expert on the ship.
Well, and he's really quite interestingly, and he's looking into this, and he's going to speak to us in a day or two with his assessment of it. Thank you so much for the rich explanation of the history of this this ship. It truly is fascinating.
Oh, there's lots more. There's
yes,
lots
I know. More, I know. And we might actually do something.
Ghost stories and all sorts about the Saldanha. She's remembered by local people. Whether the British Army and the Navy remember those poor men who they press ganged into service or not, I can't imagine. But the local people in Port Salon and Fannad remember the Saldanha and remember the tragedy that ship was. And the lighthouse stands there because of it, because fundraising went on to get to build the lighthouse at Fannad Head.
Okay.
So it's very much a local celebrity, the Saldanha.
Thank you so very much indeed. That's Anne Cadwallader. And as I say, it's something we might dig into a little bit deeper shortly. The episode 5 of the Greg Hughes podcast is available for you on our website tomorrow from 11 a.m. And our guest this week, well, it's a powerful conversation with renowned journalist Biddy McLaughlin. Most know her for her sharp columns, but in her new book, Tales of a Patchwork Life, she chronicles the devastating 2006 murder of her sister Siobhan at the hands of her husband Brian Kearney. In the podcast, Biddy pulls no punches regarding Ireland's justice system, discussing the cushy reality of life behind bars for killers, the grueling cycle of parole hearings, and why she's now campaigning for life to mean life to protect grieving families. We're going to play you a preview of that podcast now. I will warn you, though, that one of the key topics in this topic, in this podcast, is domestic abuse and quite graphic descriptions contained within. It's fine, but just in case you have younger ears listening, or perhaps it might be triggering, but it's an important conversation. Okay, Biddy, thank you so much for joining us this evening. If I could start by asking, how long have you been thinking of writing this book, and why? Why was this important for you to do?
The memoir was on my mind a lot because when you go through situations like my family have gone, which are very abnormal for most people, you have to kind of quarantine yourself into some kind of peaceful mode and collect yourself after years of post-traumatic stress disorder, which we've all suffered from and still do. So the book was a very clear kind of structured way of putting to paper how I felt, my experiences for what they were worth, and also remembering Siobhan as the person that she was. And she was quite exceptional, as you can read in the book. And also, of course, to describe what he was like, which was appalling. Like, I refer to Brian Kearney in the book as the Savage, and it's probably the best name I can think of for him. I don't even like using his name. But the book was extremely important to me for that reason.
Yeah, obviously when this person came into your life, what was the first impressions, if you're comfortable talking about that?
It's quite extraordinary, right? Because I can rarely say this about anybody. I'm a very social person, and my family are as well. When my family met him, we all met him. There was about four of us met him together that day. My mum, who is an absolute lady and extremely friendly, could not shake his hand. And I felt just didn't feel, my immediate impression was, this is so not Siobhan. This is so not the kind of person I imagined for her. He was very nondescript. He was a small man, stocky stature. He just had no personality. There was no kind of gentleness about him. There was no curiosity. There was no manners. He just didn't hold it. He didn't shake hands. I noticed that he didn't pay much. He wasn't very attentive to Siobhan, which is very, you know, something you notice.
Yeah.
There was no emotion about him. So I didn't like him at all. And on sight, I didn't like him. And unfortunately, fortunately, she was my closest sister. But unfortunately, being her closest sister as one of them, I had to tell her how I felt because she asked me. And I said, this man is not for you, Siobhan. I said, you're vibrant, you're vivacious, you've worked so hard. I said, what do you see in him? I said, what do you see in him? As sisters would say this kind of chat.
Yeah, of course.
And she said, Biddy, he's not a womanizer. He doesn't drink, hardly. He doesn't smoke. And he's safe. Now, looking back, that was like appalling. I mean, think about that wording. And when I'm doing these kind of interviews, I always think of the women who are listening to this program, Highland Radio, or any radio program. And I always like to make the point that if someone is listening to the radio now and they're about to separate, which many people are, or they're under kind of fierce kind of stress in a house where someone is, you know, literally threatening them or saying, like, you know, separation and divorce are the most critical times for people. And I remember going to my solicitor with Siobhan and asking his advice about Siobhan when she was leaving him. And the solicitor said, you know, is there any history of violence? There was none. And he said, stay in the family home. And Siobhan wanted to stay in the family home for the sake of the children. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
But unfortunately, many sort of women and to some extent men, but we know it's primarily women, sort of make that decision themselves and wait too long, and it's all for all the wrong reasons. It's never for themselves, is it? It's for the family, it's for the kids, it's
no,
for whatever.
It's always for the sake of the child.
But to have a professional sort of enforce that, very concerning.
Yes, very concerning. And if anybody's listening there now, please, I know they say, well, where am I going to go? I have nowhere to go. There's always someone to go. Even if it is a women's refuge centre, you're better off, safer there than you are in a house with an absolute savage like he was. And there are plenty. Now, men are fantastic, as we know, and there are male victims as well. But for people that are violent and people that are vicious to women, you have to leave them. They're not going to change. They're just not. And it doesn't mean they have to be an alcoholic or anything. This guy was totally sober. He was totally sober when he throttled Siobhan, where he manually tried to strangle her, and she was still alive. She was still alive in her bed, and he'd locked the door of her bedroom. There was no escape, and she was still alive after his first strangulation. And then he pushed her with the hoof of a Dyson Hoover around her neck and hung her over the bathroom door. Now, the reason I'm saying that without flinching is because I want people to know what some people are capable of. Now, if you had told me, Greg, that my sister would have had a death like that, 2006, there's no way I would have believed that we'd have anybody like that in our family, that any of my members of my family would have a death like that, that was premeditated. And her two-year-old son was in the room next door. And he went down the following morning and he gave him a bowl of Cocoa Pops and left him on his own. You're talking about, this is like a manipulative, callous, evil man. And there are very few manipulative, callous, evil men around, but there are enough of them that need to be curtailed. We all know the amount of domestic coercion and attacks there are in Ireland. Donegal has its fair share like every other county, and domestic violence, regardless of everything, whatever happens, prison sentences are just not enough. Yeah. Brian Carney is now in Wheatfield 18 years. We have a parole coming up now, right? My 85-year-old mother, who's very unwell, my 92-year-old father, who's from Carndonagh, 92 years of age. Can you imagine? And he has to write out every 3 years a letter to the parole board to say why Brian Carney, who he is appalled by, obviously, and hates, why Brian Carney should be let out. A man who has never admitted his crimes, ever. Most people that apply for parole committed their crimes and question whether it's whether it's good rehabilitation or not. I'm not going to go there. But this man has never admitted what he did. That horrific thing he did, he's never admitted it. Why should he even be allowed parole? It shouldn't be happening.
Well, how could you even put forward an argument for parole if you are in prison for a crime you won't admit to? I mean, the parole, surely in that instance, shouldn't, because theoretically you're seeking to be released having been potentially, you know, rehabilitized for something you claim you never did. So it's an oxymoron, isn't it? Yeah.
It's an oxymoron. It makes absolutely no sense. Appalling. The other thing is that when he gets all our letters, which he will get, he will look at, and we always change the letter slightly every year, right? Depending, because this never changes. Like, this is ongoing post-traumatic stress, ongoing trauma, and it triggers my parents, particularly all of us, but particularly my elderly parents. Can you imagine? He's going to read my dad's frail writing. He's going to read the writing. He's going to read my dad's thoughts on him. He's going to read my mom's thoughts and all of our thoughts. We don't see his thoughts. We don't see anything from him. So he's there in his little library, his cozy library, looking at all these, no effect on him because he hasn't, he's no emotion. And he's no problem with that. And the parole board has no problem with that. And I have major problems with that. I learned a new word the other day, and I like learning new words. It's called liminality. And it means transitioning between, betwixt and between. That's where we are. We actually can't transition. We can't move forward because we are stuck every time we relax. And my mother is terrified of him coming out. She's elderly, coming out to get her, and I have given him so many. I mean, I have, you know, I've never stopped the fight to keep him in there. None of us have, but I, particularly my journalism and everything, and to highlight the issue. And I've never stopped, and I never will, because I absolutely despise him, obviously. The idea that men and men like him can do this and get away with it, which basically he has got away with it. He's actually sitting in prison. We are the ones who are serving the sentence. We're the ones who are going to her grave three times a week. We're the ones who are her dealing with son. We're the ones that who we love. We're the ones who are dealing with the, you know, the horrific, horrific memories, flashbacks that come back. And it never leaves us. As some actor said recently, you know, how do you deal with the loss? And we say, well, he said 50% of your day is happy and the 50% of your day is sad. And I'm a very jovial person, I can tell you, Greg, very. And all my family are. And, you know, so it's very, you know, we're very positive people, but we have to change the law. That these animals, and they are animals, I have to say, these absolutely horrific men, the few that there are, but they're getting more, by the way, we're getting more of them. As you can read in the news, every day there seems to be a new murder and they seem to get no sentences. And we are going to keep at this.
Yeah, and if I could just go even a bit, you know, earlier in often what is the, you know, the story, and I use the word story, but it's not to in any way diminish what we're talking about. We still have issues with when there are clear signs of domestic abuse and escalating behaviour, that it's not really treated in a way to prevent the inevitable death that come to pass. In other words, it's not just at the end, if I could put it so bluntly. It's when the clear signs are there, the behaviour, being able to know if someone has a conviction for domestic abuse, for an example.
Yes. Well, for anybody listening, the key signs are well known by a lot of people, but not by everybody, obviously, right? The key signs are the first thing they do is isolate you from your family, isolate you from your friends. They have a problem with your family and they have a problem with your friends. These are the first two key signs. Then they have a financial strictures on you, right? Then the belittling happens, the diminishing you, saying you've got fat, you've put on weight. Then if you ever do this, I'll take the children away, right? The threats. And it's emotional gaslighting. And that's how it starts very slowly, very slowly, not even noticeable at the beginning. But soon enough, if your family notices, your friends notice it, you're not coming out, why aren't you coming out? Oh, I have to go back. You see your friend coming, changing from a fantastically lively person into someone who's scared, who is kind of fragile, who hasn't any strength. So all the changes, these changes are subtle, but they get more alarming and more obvious as time comes on. But they are the key signs. Control. Everything's controlled by them.
Yeah, to reduce you to something only they could love as they might put it. Exactly. And also, it can also escalate to threat of suicide. If you were to leave me, I will kill myself. It will be on you. Oh, it will be your responsibility.
Exactly.
Just in relation to...
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, obviously, this individual, you know, classic coercive control signs were there. But just in this whole process of him not admitting the crime he was found guilty of and knowing that he's putting, you know, you and your elderly parents through what he is, does it ever keep you up at night that in some way he's still doing what he was doing to your sister, if you know what I mean, that he might be deriving some sort of a pleasure from this?
Oh, no, absolutely. Greg is deriving total pleasure from this. Total pleasure from this, yeah. You know, he gets a kick out of this. He gets a high out of this because he's a sadist. Like, I mean, he's an emotional sadist. He's a physical sadist. I mean, if someone did to an animal what they did to Javon, the people in marches on the streets, like all over the world, he definitely gets a kick out of this. He is the most emotionless man I've ever met. He's like a machine. In my book, I call him like a box from IKEA. There's nothing, only a box sitting in front of you. I mean, I remember and none of us ever socialized with him because we couldn't bear it. There was just a nondescript nothingness about him.
Do you then believe that by the time he was introduced to you, that he had got his emotional claws into your sister? Because, you know, she even how she described what he brought to the relationship, you know, for many people, that's not enough. And he convinced her that that's what she needs. Do you allow yourself to even consider that, or is too much time passed and two severe instances happened between now and then?
I think he was controlling from the very beginning. From the very beginning, yes. Because she was a self-made woman. She worked since she was 16 on building sites. Then she set up her own company. Then she became a chef in the Shelburne. Then she had a very successful business. Then she opened Salvi, obviously, the hotel, which is still there. And so she was her own. She wasn't, like, you know, depending on anybody. The saddest thing for me is that I had this amazing, independent, wonderful sister who was taken in by him like many women are. They're taken in. You know, this thing always, he's safe. Nobody's safe. Mm. We don't know who someone is. Someone now listening and they're like going through a crap time with somebody and they're there and they're saying, I'm afraid of him, or he won't do it, but he might do it and he's never done it before. If you have any doubts, walk out. If you have any doubts, you walk out, because you could be saving your life. You think it never happens to you, and it can, and it could, and it possibly will. You have to go, and you've got to bring your children with you.
And that's just a sample of that podcast, which is available for you to listen in its entirety from 11 a.m. on our website tomorrow morning. If you've been affected by that, the Donegal Domestic Violence Services can be contacted on 1-800-262-677, or indeed you can contact Women's Aid. Their telephone number is 1-800-341-900.
Where your opinion matters. The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
You're welcome into the second hour of the programme. Now, I've got a wee appreciation message in from a listener, and it reads, on Sunday morning, we had an incident at our home where our son, who has diabetes, got ill. We called an ambulance and it was there within 5 minutes. While treating our son, our dad fainted and we had to call another ambulance for him. Again, it was there within 5 minutes. We just wanted to say a massive thank you to the crews, who were highly professional and went above and beyond to help us. And with their treatment and guidance, no one needed to go to the hospital. Again, we want to say a massive thank you to the ambulance crews in Letterkenny from a very grateful family. On the issue of flooding will continue down south and locally until the OPW realises and listens to the councillors and people on the ground. They need to dredge the drains and the rivers. They dredge and drain the rivers. People should not dump near rivers or drains, as they will end up with blockages. Rivers need to be dredged here in Donegal. There are too many restrictions on farmers. The OPW have too many powers. We need to be proactive and reactive. Ours is flooded and this could have been avoided. That actually came in from Councillor Michael McClafferty. On the issue of beef, we should not be expected to compete against the Brazilian economy. Income there is 500 or 600 euro per month compared to over 400 euro here, 4,000 euro here, beg your pardon. Beef is twice the price here as in Brazil, meaning in reality we get around a quarter of its relative value. Brazilian homes pay 1,823 of income on food. In Ireland, 810. We cannot be forced to compete with that. Right, I'm joined on the programme now by Nolene Kavanagh of the Viewing Project, in fact, the manager of the Viewing Project. Good morning.
Good morning, Greg. How are you doing?
Thanks so much. Good. Thank you so much for calling up. How are you keeping?
I'm very well. Delighted to be here on Highland Radio,
yes,
I have to say.
Good to have you. Right, what is the Viewing Project?
So the Viewing Project is an initiative from On Green On Theatre in the heart of Letterkenny.
Everywhere claims to be in the heart of Letterkenny.
Well, look, the beating heart.
Okay.
And the idea is that we want to reach out to communities across Donegal that may not have access or available access to the theatre, and create projects off-site around the county with different community groups, youth groups, retirement groups, and engage and offer people the opportunity to engage in some art and heart.
So it's bringing the facilities, the expertise to the people,
yeah,
who can't, yeah, ordinarily come to On Green On.
Exactly. And then I suppose as well, it's about trying to engage with next generation audiences who may not be as familiar with theatre as like my parents' generation were, mm-hmm, and to try and kind of develop pathways and processes to excite and ignite the next generation on the kind of power of storytelling in relation to your lived experience and your own life, both fictional and biographical, and how that can just impact and imprint and make a difference in our community and for our own selves as well.
One of the objectives is empowering diverse voices. So how, yeah, can you see, or how do you envisage that working in reality?
So I suppose, Greg, I'd be coming from the philosophy of my own experience growing up in the west of Ireland, where my parents were from a kind of a lower socioeconomic context, and it was at a particularly difficult time in Ireland in the 1980s when a recession was very prominent. And basically, I remember my mother was, you know, she'd four kids in under her feet, like, and I remember lash and rain, mm, on an August day. And I remember her saying to my dad, listen, will you just get the kids out of the house for an hour? And there was a flyer about a Catalonian company called Els Comedians that were coming to Galway. And like, A, we didn't know what Catalonian was. We barely knew where Spain was, to be honest. And we were all piled into the car on this day where it was lashing rain. And we stood on the streets of Galway. And prior to that, we had just experienced what would have been the Paddy's Day Parade, where, you know, in a very particular time in the 1980s, where you played your tin whistle, you looked straight ahead and you got on with the gig.
Very regimental.
Very regimental, Greg. Spot on. So basically what happened was, on this particular day, lash and rain, there was this kind of thunderous noise and this kind of plume of colour that kind of filled the air. And out of this kind of electrified colour and thunder emerged a dragon. Mm. And I, as a 10-year-old, had never seen anything like it in my life. And basically, me standing on a street looking at that work is what led me to basically get creatively active and involved and have it as a way of life.
Yeah. But it should also be pointed out, the way you framed the St. Patrick's Day Parade there, for some, that's about music and colour and culture.
100%.
It may indeed actually spark something within them.
Oh my God, 100%. Yeah. I suppose what I was referencing is, was like the idea of imagination.
I do understand, but I think we elevate ourselves but not necessarily denigrate something else.
Oh no, I didn't mean it like that at all. And if that wasn't my intention.
I'm not
Janie Max, like, sure, I was in a Paddy's Day Parade and I still am.
I know, I'm
for
just
40 years.
I just know my listeners.
I totally get it.
Just to clarify that.
Yeah, no bother.
Part of it too is promoting dialogue and reconciliation. And a lot of this stuff sort of, As it's set out as a goal and an objective, a lot of this happens in the process, doesn't it? If you know what I mean, if it's set up right and...
Yeah, I think it's about not underestimating people, and also permission for, as you've kind of even outlined with the Paddy's Day Parade versus a Mockness Parade, you know, it's about allowing for it all and respecting it all, and also how one can inform or share or influence the other where it's mutually beneficial. Mm. So I suppose ultimately, like, just what the project is about is, I think it's an invitation to communities across the county to engage in creative practice, yeah, and to discover and play together and see what emerges out of that.
Yeah, exactly. And whatever might be, say, for instance, it were a play or storytelling from different groups from within our wider community, then the audience is broad and then it all is working in the way it's meant to work, a better understanding and hearing people's own stories in their own way. And I think we often learn more too when we're entertained or better engaged rather being preached to or something along those lines. How are you going to get sort of the threads out into the community? We do have a great network, don't we, around the county of groups and organisations that represent all of our communities, but also work with those communities. So there's almost a network already established.
Yeah, there's
there,
a brilliant network. And I have to say, like, it's been amazing meeting people and being out and about, and also our colleagues and within the cultural sector and within the community development and youth work sector have been absolutely legends in relation to kind of supporting or informing or sharing that information. And I've been really grateful for that. So, like, at the moment, it's kind of, I'm just in the kind of school disco dance of developing different relationships. But, like, you know, made some great inroads there in Ballyshannon with Veroiga and, you know, starting to do some work in Pedigo, the Family Resource Centre there. Martina and the team have been brilliant.
See, it's... Pedigo can sometimes be forgotten.
No, totally.
You know, I think that's actually a fantastic, I think that's a fantastic example of what you've been talking about.
Yeah.
Too, because it's, Pedigo's on the periphery of the periphery almost, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I have to say as well that the Toman complex there has been really, really, you know, really supportive. And there's an amazing cultural imprint already in Pedigo, actually, because they've got the Borderline Players. They also have, you know, a great national school who are so up for it and ready to get engaged.
Probably also a good example, too, of one of the other objectives, fostering cross-community and cross-border links.
Yeah.
Pedigo would be, Pedigo would be very close to, say, for instance, very loyalist areas of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Which I figured when I went, realised when I went camping.
I just crossed
the border and I was like, well, and this is not that long ago. It was like an eye-opener, right?
The
Union Jacks were up and all, you know what I mean? So that's, just to use that again as another example, because I know that's one of the objectives. Just in, I'm not saying to address that directly, but some of this work will be focused on sort of fostering cross-community, cross-border links.
Oh my God, totally. And I think, you know, you've kind of nailed it. Like, basically, and what I think creativity can do, I was looking at the quotes about Highland Radio from, like, Moya Brennan and Brian Freeland's side, you know, and, like, what it is about is it's affording a different expression and a permission to be able to explore imagination, but also themes of lived experiences and allow those stories to emerge where, as you say, doesn't matter where you come from, or who you are, you can interpret them as you see them and you can respond to them democratically and freely as you wish.
And you're not necessarily, but not ruling out either, going around looking for, you know, people who are already incredibly active in this space and know all the rules and know how to... Like, there's lots of people have a great story to tell, but maybe they haven't read many books. So how do you articulate a story? How do you structure something? There's supports in that regard too, which gives those people a voice, but also helps to, I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I feel, discover talent or bring talent through or platform or give them the confidence
completely,
or the skills.
Completely. Like, what's brilliant about creativity is there is no set rules. So basically it's a carte blanche, like it's an invitation. The purpose of creativity, like, even if, you know, from smallies right up to the elders, it allows you to continuously, and I know it's a real cliche, but kind of paint outside the lines.
Yeah.
So there's no direct route. Like, when you think about a musician who can't read music but is able to record their own compositions, you know, or a poet like Rita Ann Higgins, who left school at 12. And, you know, wasn't schooled in what the art of poetry is. And now she is, like, one of Ireland's most beloved poets through her own...
But that could be an advantage, can't it?
Yeah, 100% through her own process and through her own medium. And then there's the cabin down in Knocknaheeny in Cork, where rap isn't something that you would associate with a particular community in the north side of Cork. And yet they have become pioneers and Grammy nominees in rap culture in their own indigenous local parlance. Like, so in the context of that, I suppose, Greg, the Viewing Project is an opportunity to kind of like open up the potential for people across the county to have an opportunity to engage in a creative practice on their terms and within the context of their own wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a prescribing project. So it's not putting stuff on people.
No, and when we talk about these things, often are easy, as tough as it is, these things are often easier in practice and to demonstrate than to try and articulate.
100%.
And I know that. And a lot of, I've done many of these interviews and I know where this is going, but to try and get it across verbalizing, because you don't want it to be too prescriptive. You don't want to put guardrails on it. You know what I mean? And you don't want to, even given examples, if you want to give two examples, then people might think those two things are what it's all about.
Yeah, so exactly.
It is people are going to have to trust the process.
Exactly.
There's a launch on Monday the 9th of February at 11 a.m. in On Green On Theatre in Letterkenny. And do you anticipate you reach out and you engage, or are you inviting people to submit, or what? Just because people might call and say, well, I've this idea, or I'm interested in that, or how is that working?
It's a very good question. I think that, you know, I've been kind of, I suppose, connecting in with people and inviting people to contact me and go, look, you know, we have a group, or, you know, we have a community here of people who might be interested in doing an artistic activity, and we, you know, we'd love to have a chat with you about it. Or there may already be established groups around the county that are doing amazing work, and they might just want to have an opportunity to talk about that or to engage with that. Because I suppose one of the things that I do want to acknowledge and say is that this is a project that is led by On Green On, but it is supported by Peace Plus.
Yes.
And I think that the intentionality behind it is genuinely about that authentic connection and the developing of new relationships across the county through the medium of creativity, but also to kind of highlight that there is an arts venue and a long-standing one that wants to kind of reflect and integrate and engage with the demographic around the county
So we're in a space where we're not restricted by a single location.
100%, exactly. Yeah. And so I guess if there's anybody that's interested or curious, if you go on to the On Green On website, you'll find an email address for me. I think it's theviewingproject@ongreenon.com. Mm-hmm. But you'll also find my phone number, and you can just text me or give me a call.
Brilliant. Come on the journey.
Yeah, either or. Like, okay. It's all good with me.
Lovely stuff. Okay, that's fantastic. And it is important to point out that this is managed by the special EU programme body. They're helping to fund it as well.
They're 100% funding it.
Okay, so it's the Viewing Project. Get onto On Green On website. You'll see the links for it and contact details for our guest, Nolene Kavanagh, who is the Viewing Project Manager. And keep an eye out. You've heard about it now, so if you see the feelers coming into your area, engage. Nolene, anything else to add?
No, just live it, love it, be it, and we look forward to connecting in with you.
Right, so we've been covering the potential dilution of the service between Donegal, Dublin, Dublin, Donegal. This is nothing to do with the Donegal Airport. They are there doing the fantastic work they always do. But a new tender went out, and I have question marks about the tender. I teased them out yesterday, and, you know, I'm a massive fan of accountability. We're all ultimately accountable in the private sector. If I do something wrong, I'm held to account on it. But there is a service that's there at the moment, but a tender went out that didn't match the service that's there at the moment. Apparently this is the same tender that's always been there. I don't know. But for one early morning flight by a certain time, one evening flight by a certain time, people tendered for it, or a company did. They received the tender, and then they've announced this schedule, which is useless really for much of the use of this link to Dublin. It's a PSO. We're paying for it through our taxes. But what is the lived potential impact of these flights, either A, being at the wrong time, or B, not being as reliable as they are now? Kathleen Griffins from Gwydor and joins me on the show now. Kathleen, thanks so much for your time. I know it's not for everyone to speak publicly, but the more voices we have, I think, on this story, the better we have a chance of getting a resolution. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Like, it's very, very hard. Like, I'm speaking on behalf of myself and other cancer patients that use this service. We relied heavily on it, and we relied on it. You would go up in the morning flight. You might come down in the afternoon flight, which would have been at 1 o'clock. Or if you couldn't make that, you would make the 6 o'clock flight. But they're trying to do away with the afternoon flight, which is very, very hard for somebody that's up there having treatment or up there having surgery and having to come back down and having to wait till the evening flight. They just need to take into account all that. Like, I know it's a business to them, but a lot of people in Donegal that are sick, not even just cancer patients, there's a lot of other patients that use it as well. Children use it. Like, they need to take that into consideration as well, like how much it is used by the Donegal sick people.
Yeah, and not to,
because we rely heavily in Dublin.
Not in any way contradicting you either, but they're getting paid anyway. If those flights go up and down empty, they're getting paid. And in fact,
exactly.
Extra money is just gravy for them. But Kathleen, just from your reality of your treatment, and I'm pleased to hear it's going well for you, but you were diagnosed with ovarian cancer 3 years ago, and you had to get treatment in Dublin. So you would arrive at the airport for the flight. What time? Can you talk to me about the process of getting to Dublin and to the hospital using the early morning flight up until now, if you don't mind, Kathleen?
Yeah, I would get my appointment for Dublin. I would ring Mary or Annalyn up in Door that looks after the cancer flight. I would tell them what time my appointment was, and they would look after all the, make sure that I would be on the flight, what time my flight was at it, and to be able to get back down. So I would ring them. They would ring me back. Yes, you're on it. You would be able to take somebody with you, you know, be somebody, a friend, your husband or your partner or whatever. You could take them with you. And it was just great because you would land over the airport. You'd be up in Dublin within, from the time I would leave the house till I would be in Dublin in the hospital, it would be less than 2 hours.
Wow.
If I would have to drive, you're looking at over 6 hours.
Yeah.
Depending on traffic, depending on everything. And then you mightn't be able to get back down. So that means you'd have a cost of having to stay in Dublin. And then, you know, that means there's an extra cost of having to get a hotel in Dublin and can come back down the following day. Like, at least the flights, they're handy.
Yeah.
You go up, if you couldn't make the afternoon flight, you'd make the evening flight. If you couldn't make the afternoon flight, you'd ring Mary and Annalyn. They would change the flight for you automatically and you'd get the afternoon flight. You know, sometimes your appointments would run over. So it was very, very good. Like, it just worked. But the way it is now, it's not going to work for everybody.
And anybody who has themselves gone through cancer treatment or is going through cancer treatment, they would know the treatment can be tough, right? But you're waiting on blood tests. You're waiting to find out that everything's clear, that you can get your treatment. You know, you just want to get these treatments because you want to get better or as well as you can. So with that in mind, you're not going to... So just for listeners who may not be aware, under the new proposals, the aeroplane would stay in Dublin overnight and it would fly up empty probably at 6:30. Now, that would be dependent on weather in Dublin, if it were delayed because of Boeing 737s heading somewhere else or what have you. People wouldn't know until that plane took off whether or not, and in fact, to be honest with you, wouldn't know for sure if it was going to be fit to land in Donegal Airport. So that brings uncertainty. So what do? You say, well, I'm going to have to go down the night before then, because I need to get this treatment. I have to get this treatment. I've been waiting on it and I can't risk not getting this plane. And it's that type of expense, hassle and uncertainty that would be brought into a person's cancer journey that we don't need, Kathleen.
Exactly. Like, there was, like, I'm speaking on myself, there was one particular time the flight didn't go off and I needed to be in Dublin. But they did put on a bus. But I was so unwell, I could not go on the bus. I just couldn't go on the bus. So I actually had to ring the hospital and I ended up, they were able to take me in Letterkenny, like, because I was that unwell that I was lucky enough that the Letterkenny, the Dublin hospital, were able to get in contact with Letterkenny and Letterkenny took me. So I was very lucky in that way. But there is times, if the flight doesn't go, they will put on a bus, but that isn't always going to work for somebody that's very unwell. Mm. It's just not going to work. And like you said, they're going to get paid anyway. So why would they leave Donegal to go back to Dublin, stay overnight in Dublin, to get back down in the morning? It just does not make sense.
It doesn't make sense because whoever...
So can they not just do as they're doing?
Yes, it's but whoever drafted the tender, I don't know if it's a civil servant, the government, whatever, they tendered for what they needed to do, and they're doing that, but it's no good. And someone should have spotted this before now, because this is causing stress and anxiety. And I think hopefully we'll get a resolution to it, but what about the stress between now and then? Do you think, Kathleen, yes, from your...
Because you don't know when you can book your flight.
Well, that's
you
it, of course.
After a certain date, whether you're going to be able to get the flight. So, I mean, it's going to put an extra financial cost on patients.
Yes, but my concern is for the patients who don't go for the treatment. You talked of a six-hour bus journey down, the treatment, having that six-hour bus journey back. How many people, Kathleen, will never know, would simply say, I am not doing it. I will live out the rest of my life as best as I can, but I am not doing 12 hours on a bus. And that's...
And I can understand that, because when you're unwell, the thought of having to, like, no harm, but going to Dublin, for me anyway, when you're well, is bad enough. But when you're unwell, I can't imagine people would be saying, no, I can't do this. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you're unwell. You know, I can't imagine them saying, no, I can't do it. But
all right.
The other choice is, if you don't do it, you know,
exactly.
Where are you left? You have to do it.
All right, you're
for your life.
It's 3 years since your diagnosis. I understand you nearly finished your treatment now, and hopefully things are going well.
Yes, I'm finished now my treatment. I'm just keeping very well now at the minute. I'm just being checked all the time, and so I'm on the other side of it. Please,
well
thank
done.
God.
Well done. Well done. Yeah. Love to hear that. Thanks so much, Kathleen.
Thanks.
Kathleen Griffin there. We are continuing to... I suppose you could say bombard the Department of Transport with a view to getting some clarification or even an interview in relation to this with the Minister with Responsibility, who's an old friend of Donegal, Dara O'Brien. And of course, we do know, we heard from Senator Boyle, Piers Doherty, Deputy Piers Doherty, Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher, that this is an issue that's being raised in the Houses, but also hopefully directly with the minister responsible. I just want answers in relation to who put together the tender and why it didn't match the service that people already have, because that was really had the opportunity to be exploited, and not exploited with malice, but in other words, say, all right, okay, well, we can do that for that money because we'll fly out at six, you know, and we'll go up and we'll leave the plane in Dublin overnight, but it's no good for us. Greg, will the operators of the aircraft flying from Dublin to Carrickfinn in the early morning be paid the PSO levy for a full capacity, even though this flight will seldom have any passengers? Will they get paid anyway? See, it's supported by public money. Is Donegal paying the price for the possible reintroduction of the Derry to Dublin flight? No, I don't believe it is, to be honest with you. Now, we're joined on the programme by Cathal. Good morning, Cathal. Thank you for your time today.
Morning, Greg. Good morning, listeners.
Right, you're talking about the cross-border scheme, aren't you, where people can, in certain circumstances, get the treatment in a private hospital in Northern Ireland and then receive a partial or full reimbursement from the HSE?
It's similar to that. I wasn't in Northern Ireland, though. I went to Kingsbridge in Sligo.
Aha, I get you,
and,
right.
It wasn't into Northern Ireland. And about a year and a half ago, the HSE got in touch with me. I was a patient a long time suffering from the back, and they asked me, would I go that way to Sligo? And I jumped at the chance and went up and seen the doctor up there, lovely man, Dr. Patel. And after getting scans and everything else, he said to me, he said he was going to give me 8 injections into the back to see would that work.
Mm.
And I went up and I got the injections and everything. The injections, I got them about September last year.
Yes.
But now they didn't have much effect at all. I had a bit of relief for a day or two, and that was all.
Right.
So he said then he would have to burn the nerve endings on the back. And it might sound horrific, but it's all done now through keyhole, and it's not so bad at all.
You got the right side of your back done, and you do seem to have some relief from it.
I did, yeah, because I was taking a lot of medication and I stopped taking some of it. I tried to wean myself off it because I'm on this medication for 5 years.
Yes.
And it must be killing me, liver and everything else. But, yeah, about 3 weeks ago, I went up and I had the right side done, the burning off. And he said to me, he said, I'll give you a call now for about 3 weeks' time and get the other side done. But a secretary rang me yesterday and she says, we applied for the HSC to get the other side of your back done. And they said, no, that they weren't paying for any more treatment for you.
Wow.
For the doctor to Patel to send all the information that he has now to the HSC. So it's just in a quandary about it.
Is this under the National Treatment Purchase Fund then?
Yeah, well, I didn't have to pay anything at any time to Kingsbury.
Right, I think it must be the National Treatment Purchase Fund. So, I mean, are you at the point yet? Did the secretary tell you how much this might cost if you were to go ahead with doing the nerves on your left side?
No, she never mentioned anything about money. Every time I've seen Dr. Patel and the secretary and all that up there, money was never mentioned.
Wow. So you're halfway through a procedure that actually seems to be working for you when the HSE have pulled the pin.
Pulled the pin. I was just wondering, did they do that with anybody else? Anybody else experience something similar?
And I suppose, too, from that, what did they do, hopefully, to continue the treatment? Because you're obviously very happy under the care of Dr. Patel, and it seems that maybe if you get the left side done, you might finally get some relief from...
It might finally get... Now, he did even say to me, he said, this pain relief might only last a year and a half or so.
Well, you'll take that.
I said, I don't mind.
No, you'd take
even
that.
Even to get that, yeah.
Of course you will. There's nothing worse than back... Well, back pain is so debilitating. It affects sitting up, lying down, moving, everything. Cahill, leave it with us, right? We'll make our own inquiries ourselves, but also throw it out to the listeners if they've ever been contacted by the HSC. If you can find out if it's under the National Treatment Purchase Fund, maybe give Caroline a text or a call, because that might help us to find out exactly how you're being treated privately in the Republic through the HSC, or maybe it's the cross border treatment, I don't know. But we'll find all that out, Cahill, and chase it up. And in the meantime, if any listeners have any info.
I'm almost sure it's similar to the cross-border, to the cross-border thing. But I'll check up my letters from them and I'll give Caroline a wee ring back.
Lovely stuff, Cahill. Listen, hopefully we can get some sort of clarification or resolution. Look after yourself. If you're in and about Letterkenny today, by the way, please keep an eye out for Students of St Union's. They're on the Market Square in Letterkenny and they've gone out to collect signatures for their petition. They want the Minister for Education to review funding for the new school building there. The petition is also available on Highland Radio's Facebook page and the school Facebook page as well. So obviously politicians are trying to advocate. We heard from the principal last week, spoke very clearly of the need and the disappointment and the false dawns, and also the fact that planning permission could expire next year. So there is time pressures on this. But if you do see those students, they're out there off their own bat looking for signatures. Please support them. Geraldine, how are you?
Not too bad.
Right, so we were speaking to Cahill before the break. He was referred to Kingsbridge in Sligo and received the injections. Didn't work for him, and then got one half of his back done with lasers. And now the HSC have said, that's the end of it. We're not funding anymore. And your situation is almost identical, is it?
Yeah, it is. I had mine done in Ballykelly.
Yeah.
My injections. I previously had a double knee replacement in Ballykelly. And I was sent in then to the spine. And I had 4 injections into the spine. And they didn't work.
Mm.
So they didn't. And they said the only option they had was surgery. Like, they more or less said that they knew that the injections wouldn't do very much for me because my lower spine was so bad.
Right.
And I had the surgery booked for the 15th of October last. And a week and a half before the surgery, Ballykelly had contacted me and said that and couldn't go ahead because the National Treatment Fund had pulled the funding. And it was being transferred back to the orthopaedic department in Letterkenny, which I have seen Dr. Shazu in Letterkenny. They wouldn't accept the scans from Kingsbridge and Ballykelly. So they were putting me forward for new scans, and I asked how long that would take. They didn't really know.
So you're back to square one as a public patient again?
Back to square one as a public patient. Transferred now, waiting on a call to Galway. He was transferring me to Galway because they don't touch the spine in Letterkenny.
How bad's the pain, and how big of an impact is this having on your life? I kind of think I know the answer to this, because back pain can be so debilitating.
Back pain can be terrible, and it affects me my leg.
Yes.
It takes the power. When the nerve is completely trapped, it takes the power out of my leg, but I'm more or less dragging the leg behind me if I walk any distance. I can't sit to watch TV at night because the nerve gets trapped and the pains go down the leg, and something with my leg hopping in front of me.
Geraldine, were you given any explanation as to why there was this change in this funding model?
They said that more or less that I had had enough treatment in Kingsbridge and they weren't funding anymore. I went through to a few different places, but was no avail.
So, in other words, the medical professionals they trusted to do the initial care, now all of a sudden they don't trust their advice that you need to have this operation, so therefore they're not funding it. You've had enough. Geraldine, I'm so incredibly sorry with what you're going through. We're going to inquire about this on behalf of you and Cahill as well. Well, not you specifically as such, unless you wish us to, but to try and get some answers, because I think you could be waiting years and years now back in the public system.
Oh, that's what I know. I mean, there's going to be no hope of me getting Galway, I would say, within the next 2 years anyway. The fact, going to Galway, you travel four and a half hours.
Yeah.
So you do. You have your operation, which is a big operation. It's a serious operation.
Mm.
You travel that distance back again. We're going into Ballykelly. It's less than an hour.
Especially when you're talking about back and nerve issues. Okay, Geraldine, leave it with us. We do have, hopefully, some contacts to in the private hospital sector. Hopefully, maybe they might be able to give us some indication as to how widespread this is and how many people are being seen. Right. Business Matters podcast is available for you today. And Chris Ashmore, its presenter, is with us. We'll start with some news. Chris, good morning to you. And a milestone, a big milestone for Ardragh Distillery.
That's right. They have just filled their 10,000th cask. So that's quite a landmark. The distillery there is now producing 440,000 litres of alcohol annually. That's a lot. And nice Donegal success story. They are exporting to more than 15 countries, including, obviously, the UK, Germany, France, Belgium. Also further afield into America as well. So looking good for them. And I suppose the most well-known whisky is the Silky Irish whisky range. So we will watch with interest as they continue to develop and expand.
Also expanding is the National Residential Retrofit Plan. A lot of people poo-poo it, have cynicism or criticism, but there's also an awful lot of people who are engaging with many of these schemes. You'll see solar panels and insulation vans all over the place, Chris, and there's more money going to be available.
Yes, now some of the grants have been increased quite a lot. If you go onto the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, that's SEAI, website, the app on the phone is very good. They actually have a lot of case studies and video clips, so you can find out, you know, what might be suitable for you. Of particular interest at the moment, under the new plans, that there's grants of up to €5,600 available for doing your doors and windows. Now, this is a big increase in what was there before. So it's not just all about the solar panels. Certainly, a lot of people have old windows and doors, so that's quite significant. The grant for a new front door, for example, You can get up to €800 there for that. So it's worth checking out. As I say, go to the website because it is full of information and it's pretty clear. There also, there's a one-stop shop facility. You can go down that road and they do all the form filling for you and you can get a package and you can do it over a number of years. And there's also, if you do have to, you're going to probably have to foot a certain amount of money yourself, but there are lower interest rate loans that tie in with this. So worth checking out.
Almost 1,000 residential buildings under construction in 25.
Yes, now this is a thing called a geodirectory residential report. And for the last quarter in Donegal, it basically tracks how many new properties are being built. And in 2025, there were 867 new residential addresses that were actually registered. So it just reflects the building that's going, the amount of building work there. And in fact, the latest figures, not everywhere had an address that was actually being built, but they say that there's 998 residential buildings were actually under construction in this county in December 2025.
I can't find out if the derelict property grant properties are involved in those figures.
No one can tell me.
Can we just jump forward to what's on today's podcast, then maybe we can go back, Chris?
Sure.
Because you do have an interesting guest, and I want to give our listeners a taster.
Yes. Now, I've been visiting Elaine Lingard, who runs Emerald Education, which is in Bundoran. Now, she comes from a teaching background. She founded this company initially tutoring children in person. She went online. She specializes in maths and English and ended up tutoring children from all over the world, from Portugal.
Quite literally all over the world.
Yeah, to the United States, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Australia, United Arab Emirates, to name but a few. She offers tuition for children aged from 5 to 18. She's also written a number of books as well and has some handy little tips that help children learning. Very much likes to think outside the box as well. And we have a clip of her here.
Right, the first one I published is called Master Your Times Tables in a Month, and it is a wonderful little book that's full of the tricks that I teach students to learn their times tables. Lots of kids really struggle with learning their tables, so this, to me, was a real passion project. It has lots of funny little tricks. One of the tricks that I really like teaching them, kids like absolutely disgusting things, don't they? So one of the facts that they find hard to remember is 8 times 8. So we say, I ate, I was sick on the floor. 8 times 8 is 64. So that one is really fun. And another one is we say 5, 6, 7, 8. So 7 times 8 is 56. It's like the times table fact backwards.
And these little things, they'll remember them, and it just makes it that bit easier.
Yeah, for sure. So the book is full of all those little funny little facts to remember times tables and lots of practice. So it's really possible to master your tables in a month if you really want to work at it.
Elaine Lingard there, and she sounds like she enjoys what she does, Chris. You had an interesting conversation, and it's available in its entirety really soon on our website as part of this week's Business Matters.
That's right, and the programme itself going out after the 6 o'clock news on Sunday.
And if anyone wants to get in contact with Chris, I can't imagine a single reason why.
No. Best way is by email, businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Darts is great for maths, I think.
Yes.
Playing darts.
Yes. Yeah.
Really good. Really is good.
Yeah, absolutely.
As soon as you're engaged in something or enjoying something,
it just comes naturally. Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. Thank you very much. Chris is back with us next Thursday. The podcast available very shortly on our website, highlandradio.com. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for watching, texting in, calling in, whatever. We appreciate any interaction with you at all. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9.